If you're a marketing executive running a brand, there's all kinds of pressure. How do I get my return on investment for that 30 seconds, which this year is running at least $8 million just to buy that 30 seconds, and
Yeah.
then millions more in production costs to pay a celebrity? That's millions more potentially. So it's an expensive endeavor, and it's a high risk endeavor, because this thing can still like make or break careers.
Hello and welcome to Outlines, a podcast about sport, stories and the media. My name's Owen Connolly. Hope you're well. It is great to have you listening. The Super Bowl. You've probably heard of it. The NFL's championship game is a phenomenon unlike anything else in US popular culture. A TV juggernaut that continues to deliver gigantic audiences year after year. An estimated 127.7 million Americans watched in 2025. That's a little over a third of the population, and you can expect something pretty similar when the New England Patriots take on the Seattle Seahawks this Sunday, as I'm talking, in Santa Clara, California. That obviously adds up to an event that resonates way beyond the game itself, beyond even what Bad Bunny gets up to at halftime. An audience of that sheer scale is a unique opportunity for the networks and for American advertisers who've long since built their own economy, conventions, and rituals around Super Bowl Sunday. So that gives us a chance to do something a little bit different with this episode and think about how brands will take their 30-second shot at telling their story around a big sporting set piece, a reported cost of $8 to $10 million each. Our guest this time is EJ Schultz. He's the news editor of Ad Age, and for about the last decade and a half, he spent this part of the year scrutinizing the efforts of brands and agencies lining up their very biggest swing. We talk about how the Super Bowl ad has evolved in the digital era, the tactics companies use to generate buzz for their commercials either side of the big game, the strategic importance of these spots, what differentiates them from other campaigns, and some of the creative and cultural trends that define them in this moment, from celebrity endorsements to humor and political sensitivity. We compare the Super Bowl as a US media platform to the Olympics and the FIFA World Cup, both looming this year, of course, and EJ picks some recent and not so recent favorites. Some really, really fascinating stuff to come. Quick note, important note before we go on. If you're a regular listener, you might have noticed we've just come off our own bye week, and the podcast is actually going to shift now, for the next little while at least, to a fortnightly schedule. So the next episode will be in a couple of weeks' time, and so on. Not going anywhere, not disappearing. It's just an adjustment I've had to make to the production workflow. I'm aware as well that a lot of you are taking this series at your own pace or catching up on earlier episodes, so this will give you a breath to do that. It'll give me some time as well to fill out some of the supporting content around the podcast. But suffice to say, there are some very exciting guests coming up over the next couple of months and beyond. So do stay with us. If you're enjoying the podcast, then please subscribe, rate and review on your platform of choice. Let people know about the show. Steer your friends and colleagues towards past conversations you've particularly liked and think they will too. Social media details, as always, in the show notes, so feel free to get in touch there. Let's keep this moving. And let's get this episode moving as well. Time now to cut to the commercials. Here is EJ Schultz. So something I'm not sure if I've been ignorant of this, or if I'm now seeing something in it that I was, you know, that I'm kind of projecting onto it or reading something that's not there. But Ad Age is a play on the word adage, right?
Not really. We actually used to be called Advertising Age formally, and we switched it to Ad Age just to have a shortened version. But it's more literal than you're giving us credit for. Just Advertising Age.
So that's the English grad in me trying to overthink and overread stuff. Well, yeah, it's great that you're able to join us. So hopefully you'll give us kind of quite a good overview and sense of what the market's like, as well as what the ritual of kind of the Super Bowl is like, and because it's in such a fascinating place that you have this single kind of magnetic point of the broadcast year in the US. I mean, I know lots of other, particularly NFL games, but lots of other football games kind of draw bigger crowds than other TV. But, you know, for advertisers, this is just unlike anything now when everything's got as diffuse as it has. You know, the discipline of creating an ad for the Super Bowl, I think is going to be something quite fun to get into. But let's just start with the personal, because, you know, I was keen, as we were saying before we start recording, to talk to someone who wasn't just well-versed in advertising, but was an American who kind of grown up with the particular traditions and kind of conventions of sitting and watching the Super Bowl every year. I mean, how central are the commercials to your experience, personally and professionally? Like, we'll separate.
Sure, yeah. I mean, for me personally, there was the Super Bowl before I started working at that age, and then after. And I've been here for like 15 years now, so it's kind of ingrained in me. Before I worked at that age, I most every Americans, I sat down to watch the game. I didn't read a lot about the ads ahead of time, but it was still something we all watched, right? It's the one TV moment where you're actually looking forward to the ads. And I'm going to probably age myself here, but I still have some classic memories of the ads I watched as a kid watching the game. Back to the Bud Bowl was always a big one, when they had the little cans of beer playing football against each other, Budweiser versus Bud Light. I remember some of the classic Pepsi ads, some of those things that are just sort of ingrained in your memory. And but since I joined AdAge, it's become sadly much more of a work event for me. And, you know, ever since social media has come to play, most of us at AdAge, you know, we're writing about this event in earnest, like, you know, 2 or 3 weeks ahead of time. You know, we're writing a lot about ads before, you know, a lot of, obviously the custom now is a lot of brands release their ads early. So we're analyzing everything a lot sooner, right? And then game day, I'm usually, you know, I know some of my colleagues actually will still go to a Super Bowl party. But for me, it's like, I can't balance having fun and working at the same time. So I just like, I kind of like plant myself in my basement. I got my TV on and I'm like, my head's buried in my laptop. And we're just sort of like watching, you know, see what kind of reception some of the ads are getting as they're actually shown during the game, monitoring social media, doing Slack chats with my colleagues about what we need to jump on, what we don't need to jump on. And then, you know, we have all our post-game coverage that comes out. A lot of it's written ahead of time, obviously, because we get a chance to see most of the ads ahead of time. So we'll do our traditional, like, Super Bowl ad review, which my colleague handles, Tim Nudd, for the last few years. But there is just a whole lot of content.
Yeah. Yeah. And like, what's the experience of watching it live now like then, when you've got so many that are trailed before and some that are kind of, you know, you have almost campaigns around this 30-second to 60-second spot that start on Instagram, like sometime in late December or something.
You know, the thing I always remind myself is, you know, we will dissect the heck out of these at AdAge as we're getting them in advance, and we're posting them on our website as we get them, writing stories about them. But for the most part, I would say, like, most people experience them and see them for the first time when they're watching the game. And it's a completely different experience than if you're just watching an ad in isolation. Because it's grouped together in a single commercial break with usually, you know, four or five other ads. And it goes by pretty quick. You know, most brands are still running 30-second ads. So to create an ad that really breaks through, we could get into more of this later. But, like, you have to check a lot of boxes, because a lot of people are watching this game at a Super Bowl party. They're with their friends. They're talking. You know, while, yes, we all kind of pay attention to this is the one time of year we all pay attention to the ads, there's still a lot of distractions happening. And maybe you're watching at a bar. So, right, you're there's a lot of noise. So, like, how can a brand make something like this that's still going to stand out in the midst of all that distraction?
Yeah, I mean, we will come on to that. But, I mean, you know, we've kind of settled the premise here, because some of these things can be stereotypes, but they're sort of slightly anecdotal and really, when you ask someone about it, they say, oh, that's something, you know, it's a bit of myth making from the industry, that people actually are that focused on the ads as they come. But, you know, that very much is the case with American audiences and the Super Bowl, whether it's the entire audience. And certainly I imagine those who are watching the game particularly closely maybe are going to take a little bit of a break themselves at that point and maybe take themselves away from the screen. But, you know, that is culturally, that is the case, that you know you still have that relevance for those spots.
Yeah, I mean, and it is sort of really the only thing like that left and right, with media the fragmentation of media and the hyper sort of specialization of, you know, what streaming has brought us, and everyone's got their own little niche thing that they watch. This is still one of the only kind of gather around the living room, the whole family watches it together. I mean, we're in a unique year, though, that there are a couple other things like that a little bit, too, with the World Cup and also the Olympics. It's all happening in a single year. So that those are still big sporting events that have a similar dynamic. But in the US, there's still nothing like the Super Bowl.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, we'll come on to those other events a little bit later. I mean, we have high audience events in the UK, and we have, you know, well, that's World Cup games. There used to be certain genres of television, particularly at Christmas, that used to drive kind of outsized audiences, kind of proportionally similar or even slightly higher than the Super Bowl. But the thing that we have as a separate convention here is that a lot of those things are on the BBC. So we actually don't have really anything that's quite like the Super Bowl in terms of a national TV moment that's always going to be on commercial TV. And the other thing, and we were joking about this before we started, we used to have the convention of, during a football match where you don't have lots of ads, you got one, you used to get the surges on the national grid because people would, you know, supposedly go off and all set their kettles at the same time for, you know, the 10, 15 minutes that they'd have during a World Cup game or what have you. So we don't have anything that's kind of stayed in that moment and come to this one. So like, what's a kind of potted history that you can give of the Super Bowl ad over the last kind of 20 years or so, kind of coming out of that TV first culture into digital culture, where it has become kind of increasingly the only thing that still serves this function? How's that role of the Super Bowl ad changed in that time?
Well, because now you have all these other media channels. Like if you're back, you know, three decades ago, if you bought a Super Bowl ad, that was the thing. You know, you pour all your energy into that 30-second ad. Most brands back in those times were not releasing them early. Social media didn't exist. So you could pour all your energy into that single unit of 30 seconds or a minute. Now, you know, if you're a marketing executive running a brand, there's all kinds of pressure. How do I get my return on investment for that 30 seconds, which this year is running at least $8 million just to buy that 30 seconds and then millions more in production costs. And if you had to pay a celebrity, that's millions more potentially. So it's an expensive endeavor, and it's a high risk endeavor because this thing can still like make or break careers. And so you have to surround it with enough marketing beyond the game to make that investment worth it. And that includes so-called teasers, right? Which is like trying to hype the ad with your little 10-second video teasing what celebrity you may have. And it's like, where do you spread that news? A lot of brands these days, you know, they get little placements. It's the one time, like morning TV, you can get a segment on like the Today Show, for instance, and literally they'll have your brand on to talk about your Super Bowl ad. Like there's no other opportunity to do that. Like to literally get on a national TV show and talk about an ad. That's a unique thing. So, you know, your PR teams are working overtime to secure those placements. Your social media, your digital teams are working overtime to push this message out on social media, to put some paid support behind your social media posts, all surrounding this very expensive 30-second ad buy. And if you don't put all those things in place, you risk kind of wasting money.
Yeah. So in that respect, is that partly because you know you're not going to get the viewership for, you know, you can't do all that in TV ads basically because you're not going to get the same viewership on subsequent runs, or you're not going to be able to create a character in a TV ad and then have them live on for, you know, 6 months, 2 years, 3 years after that? Or is it just that the media has become so diffuse now that you sort of have to be preparing?
I think it's really
for the thing.
I think it's as simple as, like, if you convince your CEO that to give you the budget to do a Super Bowl ad, they're going to want to see the return on investment, and so that you're going to want to surround it with enough other marketing. Like, I did a story at Ad Age a while last week on automotive brands in the Super Bowl, and a lot of them have kind of pulled back from it. We don't see as many car ads as we once did. But I think, you know, the car ads that do come in, they, you know, oftentimes it's about a new model launch. You have a new updated model, right? And you're trying to create news on that. And so the ad itself is going to be something that's very high level. It's going to have a punchline. If, you know, it's going to be very simple, but you have to surround that with a full 360-degree campaign to do some of the harder work of that campaign, which is to let people know, what are the new features in this vehicle? You know, what am I getting if I buy this? And that, a lot of that has to, you're pulling on multiple levers to achieve that, right? You're using channels that allow you to go to a little more detail. So you kind of, the ad itself is really around creating awareness, and then you're hoping to hook enough people to, like, search for that product online, and then hopefully have all the marketing in place to deliver, you know, to keep people curious and to give them information about whatever you're selling.
Yeah. With all that in mind, have the ads themselves, have those spots that actually end up in the broadcast, have they become more or less relevant to the wider advertising, brand advertising picture, you know, from your seat, as particularly over that last 15 years, where we've gone from digital being a supplementary thing, maybe for a lot of audiences, to it is the thing that's dominant, particularly for advertisers who kind of, you know, maybe are targeting more, or maybe they are doing higher volume stuff, or what have you. The fact that you are in that, you're in that carousel, is that more important now than it was 15 years ago?
Yeah, and I can give you an example of that. It was a couple of years ago, when the initial crypto burst, Coinbase did a Super Bowl ad, and their Super Bowl ad literally consisted of a bouncing QR code, right? It was very weird looking. It stood apart for sure from any other ad. But, you know, the idea obviously to get people, just, what the heck is this? I want to scan it and take me to the website, you know? So there's a lot more effort to connect the analog experience to the digital experience. One classic way to do that is some sort of sweepstakes, right? But now you have all these digital tools you can get people to enter, like, literally as they're watching the ad. And that's a great way to measure sort of the interest you're getting. So there's a lot of that going on, right? Connecting digital to the TV ad.
Yeah. Some of those crypto companies also getting a kind of air of legitimacy that maybe we slightly regret lending them a few years.
Yeah.
Later.
I mean, that's the other thing about us. I mean, I could go on and on about the pros and cons of a Super Bowl, but one of them, like, you kind of hitting on this, is like, oh, maybe you're buying some trust. If this brand has enough money to buy a Super Bowl ad, there must be something to it, right? It's not a fly by night, but there have been examples of brands that have run Super Bowl ads and gone out of business within 12 months. So it's not a sure bet.
Yeah. I want to kind of take it into slightly more of creative direction, the conversation. I mean, the other thing, we talk about the scale of the Super Bowl audience, but that's going to make it unlike any other audience that you've got in American media, basically, because, you know, we're so used now to different niches, different demographics following different, you know, they might be on, it might be something that's filtered through social media, it might be an entirely kind of siloed media experience in some cases, particularly with the kind of political dimension to American media in the 2020s. This is the broadest possible audience that you're going to get anywhere. So how do brands start thinking about that? Are they thinking, well, we'll target our audience, and if, you know, in 30 seconds another brand will be along to target theirs? Or are they thinking, right, this is our big shot to kind of get to everybody all at once?
Yeah, I mean, just to put a number on that, last year 127 million people in the US, average of that many people tuned in, right, across, it was on Fox last year, so it was like across Fox and Tubi, which is a streaming platform. So you're right. I mean, there's nothing else remotely close to that. I think to answer your question, really depends on the brand. I mean, I guess there is a way to use this, you know, if you are more targeting more of a segment of that 127 million people, this is a way to, like, guarantee that that segment is tuning in. So even if you're targeting just a portion of that 127 million people, it's a pretty sure target, if that makes sense. Because
yeah,
outside of this game, you know, a lot of people are paid a lot of money to find that audience in other more precise ways, which are a lot cheaper. But this is just a blunter instrument to reach that audience. But, you know, a lot of if you're a mainstream brand, you do need to make sure that this is going to resonate with multiple generations. One example, you know, traditionally, Suwad's nostalgia has been a huge thing in America in the last few years, you know, and I think probably even globally. And but Suwad's have used nostalgia forever. But it's like, if you're using nostalgia, it's kind of funny. Like, if you're a Gen Z, right, nostalgia might be 10 years ago, right? Where if you're like a boomer in Gen X, that just seems like yesterday. So if you're referencing something that's nostalgia, knowing this is a mass audience, like figuring out, you know, how that's going to resonate with different generations. Last year, Hellman's, the mayonnaise brand, ran an ad.
I was about to say.
And they referenced When Harry Met Sally. And I guess when I initially saw that, I'm like, does Gen X even know what the heck this is? Gen Z, I mean, even know what the heck this is? But a lot of people will say one of the interesting things that's happened is because of streaming and because of social media, some of these old entertainment properties that were around like literal decades before some of these young people were born have taken on new lives. And whether it's memes or, you know, watching it on streaming, you know, there's a whole audience that watches Friends, right? That wasn't around when it was actually airing. So some of these things have new life. And I think that's why you pay a lot of money to consumer researchers to like figure out what are these old nostalgic moments that still can have resonance with a broad audience, right? That you're going to get the joke right away.
Yeah. The Hellman's one was really interesting because they've like a few brands have done that with older, particularly 80s film properties or early 90s. So you've had, I think Macaulay Culkin has popped up somewhere.
Right.
Might have been Amazon. I'm not sure. And Matthew Broderick as Ferris Bueller and things like that.
Right. Yeah.
But the Hellman's one, to your point about the multi-generational thing, because I saw a thing about this last year, and the first thing they did was obviously, you know, sadly Rob Reiner is no longer with us, but his mum obviously was not around to reprise her role. Was it last year or the year before?
Hellman's ad was last year.
Yeah. So they replaced it with Sydney Sweeney, which was quite a left turn in that scene.
Right.
But the other thing I saw was because one of the reasons that it's kind of gone viral from time to time with Gen Z is kind of the chunky knit sweaters and things like that. And they kind of kept a lot of the wardrobe consistent from the same scene, right. But they had Billy Crystal in this giant white sweater that he wears somewhere else in the movie, because that's the thing that kind of people, you know, there was like a viral thread a couple of years ago where it's like people want to get into that movie and crawl around because of all the textures and stuff, and that jumper is one of the things that they talk about. So yeah, I suppose those are some of the creative calculations that a brand will make.
Yeah, and another example of a little bit different angle on this, but it's like kind of how do you play into like internet memes, internet culture? An example of that this year is Fanatics, the sports betting brand and sports brand, doing their first ever Super Bowl ad promoting their sports book, and they've got Kendall Jenner in it. And the whole hook there is playing into this lore of Kendall Jenner. When she has dated NBA players, they sometimes go into a little bit of a funk. And so the ad kind of plays into that. And I don't know if like all 127 million people are going to get that joke. Like, I don't think my mom will get that joke. But they don't, you know, that's not who they're marketing to, but they still think it's worth it to spread this thing that's a little niche-y.
Yeah.
But still, it's got the other elements of the ad. I mean, most people, even if you don't know that inside joke on Kendall Jenner, you kind of know who she is. So at least, you know, the ad resonates on that level, right? So there's different layers, I think, of these Super Bowl ads. You can put little inside jokes in there that maybe only, you know, a quarter of the viewers might get. But if that's the sweet spot of the audience you're targeting, then that's worth it.
And if you can find the premise kind of is relatable enough, then, you know, people will find out about the detail in their own time. The other significance of this, and, you know, you've talked about your viewing habits now diverge from some of your colleagues in this respect, but like Super Bowl parties you're thinking biggest available screen, probably, you know, 3-4 foot screen kind of hanging on a wall somewhere, everybody standing and or sitting around it. It's a different kind of setting from the one that you would expect to be served advertising the rest of the time these days. Mm-hmm. You know, how does that play into some of the creative? Because we kind of got the two trends, and you know, I'm sure we'll talk a bit more about the kind of use of celebrity in Super Bowl ads as well. But you also, I suppose, have big budget in quite a lot of cases that's spent differently.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of music in these ads and visuals, and limit the dialogue to not make it something too complex, knowing exactly what you're saying. That yes, people are paying attention to ads more than they ever do, but are they sitting there hanging on every word? Probably not. You know, you got to have, you know, the Budweiser, the classic, you know, as they do every year, Budweiser is out with their Clydesdales ad. And this year's ad has an eagle, you know, sort of befriending a Clydesdale horse, right? It's their old formula, like two different species of animals making friends with each other. But it's a highly visual ad, and then it's backed by Lynyrd Skynyrd's Freebird, right? Which 90% of people know that song. And you put that on in a room with nice speakers, it's probably going to emotionally connect to a lot of people, right? And just that alone with some nice visuals. And you're not telling that complicated of a story. And so, you know, you've achieved your job there.
Yeah. And you're kind of, making use of that just visual real estate when people are, you know, they're served ads when they're scrolling on Instagram or TikTok or something half the time. And instead you get just something that's got some impact.
Now, the alternate thing to think about there is if you could do something that's provocative enough and get people to like, what was that? What did they just say? And get them to go watch the ad again online. Mm. Like that's the holy grail, but that's hard to do, right? Because most people are moving on to the game, to their conversation they're having with their friend, to the next thing. But like, how do you, but if you can achieve that, that's like probably the gold standard.
Yeah, but it's a bold use of $8 million to do something particularly arty or creative. We've hinted at a few things, but what are some of the biggest trends to follow this year?
This trend has been in place for a while now, but it just keeps getting more and more prevalent. I mean, that is humor, right? I think something like 70% of the ads are humor ads and comedy. No one wants to touch politics at all. You know, the Super Bowl used to be a place for a fair amount of like messages that are going to quote unquote unify the country or things that we can all agree on. And even that's harder to achieve these days. And it may even look a little naive at this point, given, you know, what's happening in the US right now with whether it's the immigration debate or anything else, right? It's you got to be very careful if you're doing something like that. But I will say, because most of the ads are going to be comedy ads with a celebrity punchline, they tend to kind of all run together a little bit. So I've noticed in the last couple of years, when you're seeing like six funny ads in a row and then someone comes on that's a little serious, it does grab your attention more, right? Because it's like a record scratch and like, what is this, you know? So I think we've almost gone, the pendulum has shifted almost too much in the favor of comedy here.
Yeah. Is there a degree to which by the time you've paid for a celebrity to be in your campaign, you're kind of going to dial down a little bit of the ambition elsewhere and you'll, you know, focus on the hook and the premise a little bit more and the dialogue or the bit or whatever it is that's kind of carrying your ad, because we can't now hire, you know, some Hollywood director to shoot this scene because it's, you know, we've only got so much money to go around here.
I think if you're all in, you're all in. And if you're going to get the celebrity, you're going to get the good director, because, you know, you don't want to waste a celebrity with a crappy ad, right? So I think it's like all or nothing, really. That honestly is one of my
Is it more a kind of pendulum creatively then? Because I remember a little while ago, I mean, probably around the time, if you're talking 15 years, it's probably around this time where you had, you know, particularly car ads, you had Matthew McConaughey and Eminem and this stuff that was quite kind of angsty or quite you know, it was really going for a certain gravitas. And is the current wave of ads that lean into humor more a bit of a reaction to that, as well as the kind of the social moment elsewhere? Or
I think it's mostly is representative of the risk averse nature of brands right now. They don't want to do anything that's going to get them thrown into the middle of a political debate, because we've seen instances where brands, you know, will do a serious ad, and then some viewers will read something into this that maybe the brand wasn't even trying to do. I'll give you an example of this. So a few years ago, Budweiser did an ad basically flicking at how the founder Adolphus Busch came to America from Germany. And it seemed like a pretty harmless classic story, origin story.
Yeah.
But there were some people that read some sort of, you know, claiming that Bud was making sort of statement on immigration, right, through that. And that's not that's not the conversation they wanted. They wanted to talk about the heritage of their brand, not whether or not immigration, you know, not get thrown into a political argument about it.
Yeah.
Immigration. So I think, you know, there's been countless examples in the last few years here in the US of brands suddenly being thrown into a political debate, and it's created a lot of caution. And yeah. I think the easiest way to just avoid that is just to do something that's kind of slapstick and silly and humorous, and that no one's going to ever assign any motives to you about.
Yeah. So you feel kind of warmer towards the brand, but you don't necessarily remember that
right.
much of the content.
Right.
I mean, how does that compare to the issue in that same dimension that brands have maybe some of the rest of the time, where, you know, the classic thing in the last kind of 5 or 10 years where this kind of polarization has been such an issue, or this sensitivity to the quote unquote wrong message. You know, I'm thinking of what happened to Bud Light a few years ago, where you have a very small campaign that's not meant for the audience that ends up getting offended by it, that gets conflated in news headlines or whatever else as some kind of, you know, political statement or what have you. At the Super Bowl, you have something that's probably been very carefully trialed and piloted, and obviously will have sat with media like your own for a couple of weeks before. And, you know, it might even have wound up on YouTube at some point in the days before suddenly breaking containment and going to a really massive audience. So, I mean, is there a kind of dichotomy there, or a divergence there between the way brands have to manage that challenge in those two different contexts?
I think, to your first point, I think the lesson that brands have learned in the last, you know, 3-4 years, and the Bud Light example you're bringing up is sort of a watershed moment for this, is no matter how small it is, you've got to assume you're going to like err on the side of assuming everyone could potentially see this, right? The idea of simply targeting one specific group and hoping no one else sees it that could potentially get offended, that's impossible, right? Because the message is going to spread beyond your little targeted paid campaign potentially, right? Because all it takes is some, you know, political person with millions of social media followers to post it, right? And then suddenly you've got an issue on your hands.
Yeah. Yeah. But are there any other trends that you think are worth note before we kind of slightly move on?
Yeah, I mean, I feel like just from a business case, my own point of view is like, this is an expensive endeavor, so you better have like something interesting to share. I think we've seen a lot of more just rookie Super Bowl brands coming in, you know, that it's got a new product, and so like this is like an amazing awareness tool. Like, you know, we mentioned Coinbase earlier, right? Surely by the time they ran that out, a lot of people kind of knew about Coinbase, but maybe not the mass audience, maybe not your grandparents, you know? So like it's a great venue for something new to kind of get the word out. And then for an older brand, it's a great venue if you have something new to say, if you have some new sort of selling proposition, or you're trying to rebrand yourself, it's a great one burst way to do that. I don't know anymore about a brand that's just going to like, you know, that's been in the Super Bowl for 13 years in a row. And just, if you don't have anything really new to say, like it potentially could be a waste of money now.
Yeah.
Or you're just trying to entertain your fans. I mean, I guess if that could help your brand, but,
But just because anything that you introduce has got to live on kind of the rest of the year and across all these other different channels.
I mean, I can give you an example. A couple that I think are smart on that, like this year that have already been out. So Instacart, right? The food delivery brand. They've kind of got the formula. They got Ben Stiller and Benson Boone in their ad. And they're doing sort of and Ben Stiller's great at this. They're just sort of doing like a mock kind of 80s era band, kind of playing into like Benson Boone's proclivity to do flips, right? But there's a very simple message, and they're just singing a song over and over, and it says just Instacart lets you choose your bananas. The message there is they're promoting what they call their like produce picker function. When you're ordering bananas, you can literally say, I like bananas that are like half ripened or not ripened at all. So that's like a product benefit, right? That probably doesn't have a lot of people don't know that exists.
Yeah.
But they're selling it in an entertaining way. And it's without just being entertaining for the sake of being entertaining.
Yeah.
And then the other one is another delivery brand, actually Grubhub, and they've got a new piece of news that they're trying to spread, and that they're going to waive any delivery fees over $50. And so their whole pitch is Grubhub eats the fees. And in the ad, you see an elegant dinner, and then the punchline is George Clooney appears, and he's literally like eating the fees. So it's a very simple message, but it's a new piece of news. You've got a celebrity. It's interesting visually, and they're achieving a business goal there.
Yeah. Yeah. Two food delivery companies, incidentally, that don't exist in the UK. So I'm just trying to place them right.
If your viewers,
We get the idea. Yeah. Okay. They always have surprising amounts of money to spend on marketing as well, those companies. Something we haven't talked about at all is the NFL or American football. I mean, is there any, because I'm going to move on to kind of point of comparison with some of the other events that you mentioned earlier. But does that come into it in any dimension at all? Or is it just, this is, Anytown USA, biggest possible audience. Is that really the only kind of creative and brand consideration that's being made here?
Do you mean how much brands consider the
NFL audience, or is it just so much bigger than?
Oh, it's so much bigger. It's like just cultural. It's a pop culture event. It's as much as a football event. I mean, football, I will say though, still is. I mean, it is and growing every year. The dominant viewing routinely drew. Even the playoff games. They'll get 30 million, 40 million viewers. Right. It's half the Super Bowl audience, but it's still a massive audience with nothing else in comparison. So it's increasingly where live sports, and the NFL is king here for that, is where all the advertising dollars are going, just because that's the one of the last places to have the reach.
Yeah. Because to contrast it with the biggest viewing audience that you get here that would be comparable would be the World Cup, and will be again this summer. And what you notice during the World Cup is not just during those big live games that England or one of the other home nations are playing, but through the entire tournament and through any other live games and whatever else, lots and lots of the advertising is thematically linked in some way to the World Cup, particularly, because there will be sponsors involved, or, there might be, TV brands or FMCG brands who are like, why don't you go and get a pizza or whatever? Like, or you do a barbecue because it's going to be the 3 weeks of sunshine coming up at some point during the tournament. That is not really a thing at all, but I suppose it might be other parts of the NFL season.
We do get, and even in the Super Bowl, to answer your question, there are brands that will play into NFL culture and have NFL players in their ads, for sure. That's a segment of the ads. I don't think it's a majority, but it's, I'll just give you one example. There's a pharmaceutical brand that is running an ad that's trying to raise awareness for a new prostate cancer test that I believe is some sort of blood test, or it's an easier way than to getting tested than the traditional prostate exam. And the stars in their ad are like NFL tight ends, right? You kind of get the connection.
Right.
So there will be brands that will use the NFL players in them, like in ways like that, but obviously make them entertaining.
Yeah. Yeah. That's an image we'll move past.
Yeah. Sorry I had to bring that up, but it was the best example that came to my mind.
How is this going to compare to the Olympics and the World Cup? I mean, the Olympics, you've got frames of reference because it's still on NBC. There'll still be quite a lot of viewing that's time shifted, I guess, because it's in Italy, but maybe not as much as the last couple of Winter Olympics. But, you know, and the World Cup will probably be a bigger World Cup just by virtue of the fact that it's all happening on your continent.
Right.
But like, what, from a creative and campaign perspective, how will those two compare? Or those, the Super Bowl and those two events compare?
Yeah. So obviously with the Super Bowl ad, most brands, 90% of the brands will just buy one ad. It's all they can afford. It's all they want to pay for. So that's that mm-hmm. one shot, like we were talking earlier, it's 30 seconds all in. Make it the best you can. Tell that story in that space of that 30 seconds. I think with both the Olympics and the World Cup, if you wanted to tell a story, if you wanted to have multiple ads that sort of all work together, I think most of the hardcore Olympic fans, and maybe even beyond that, are not just tuning in to watch one particular event. It's probably over that 2 weeks, right?
Yeah.
They're going to tune in almost every day or every night. So you can have the opportunity to hit that same viewer with a couple different pieces of creative. And I actually talked to an automotive brand, Kia, that, you know, they actually said, you know, they normally had run Super Bowl ads. This is the second year they're not doing a Super Bowl ad. And the reason they're not this year is they pointed to the Olympics and World Cup, and they liked the opportunity. You know, they're promoting a new car model, and they wanted the ability. They liked the Olympics because it gave them a little more space, a little more breathing room to kind of have multiple pieces, multiple ads that could go into different angles of the model, right? We have a hybrid, we have, you know, the different features, and you can kind of have multiple ads rather than trying to squeeze all that messaging into a span of 30 seconds. So I think that's very attractive. Of course, you know, the reach calculation is much different. There's going to be much lower total number of people watching the Olympics at any given time. But if you add up the course of time they're watching it, maybe you could get some potential comparable reach between the two events, but it's just a much different way of going about it.
Yeah. And I suppose for the World Cup, you'll have quite high audiences, particularly when the US are playing, but what you'll have is a consistently high audience, or a consistently, whatever that plateau is, it will be fairly spread out across that month-long period. So again, it lends itself to even bigger, broader, more ambitious campaigns that maybe are multi-part. And
obviously, like you said, with it occurring in North America and several U.S. cities, I think you're going to get some more just curious viewers that aren't really soccer fans, just wanting to see what this thing looks like in an American city.
Yeah. Although I guess as well, they're also competing with, you know, the sponsors of the tournament get first dibs or first reason to be involved in that way.
Right.
Okay. Getting conscious of time. So let's look back at, some of your favorite Super Bowl ads of the past. I mean, what are some of your all timers? And I'm thinking as well of stuff that maybe lived before this particular media moment.
It's such a good question. It sort of like, it almost illustrates how like fleeting the Super Bowl is, because I'm struggling to think of any. But I mentioned one at the beginning, the whole like classic Bud Bowl ads, which still I remember, and these were decades ago, right? Some of the classic, I think FedEx ran a lot of Super Bowl ads back in the day. Mm. I was more prepared to answer this question just thinking of last year. Like, I was thinking, which of the ads last year do I still remember?
Yeah.
And one of them was the Nike spot, which I thought Nike hadn't advertised in the game in a long time. And it was just like, again, back to my point of like cool visuals and music, they had an interesting juxtaposition. The whole ad was talking about female athletes, and there was a great film and black and white, a lot of it, of like female track and field basketball players. And the music was Led Zeppelin. And it was it was sort of an unexpected music choice, but it worked so well with the visuals. it is really cool. I would encourage your viewers to go Google and find that one. And then on the opposite end of the extreme, and we've seen a lot of absurd humor. I don't know if it's in the case in the UK, but it's sort of a lot of brands are trying absurdity these days. And last year, an example of that was Mountain Dew did an ad, and it was Seal, the music artist, as a seal, as an actual seal, which was completely silly, but it was like worked.
Yeah. And I suppose you're seeing with that creative more of the sort of internet first kind of cultural creativity and stuff coming into what has been quite a safety first creative space, I guess.
I mean, you know, what was the classic? There's really Coca-Cola global brand, you know, and obviously, you know, do you remember the meat? It was the Mean Joe Green, the Pittsburgh player, and the kid. He's walking out of the tunnel after a tough game, and the kid turns around. The line was, "Hey, kid, catch."
Yeah.
And that one. And then the classic Hilltop ad. I think, and don't quote me on this, I think it ran before the Super Bowl, but then was shown in the Super Bowl again. You know, I'd like to teach the world to sing in perfect harmony in that spot. There's so many classic Coke ads over the years. Sadly, they're not really even in the game anymore.
But to your point, I mean, you know, the ad that everybody remembers globally, I think, is the 1984 Apple one. Mm-hmm. But, you know, when you think of what people buy adverts for, I mean, people still talk about it 40 years later.
Right.
But
yeah, that is the most classic one.
They didn't sell enough Macintoshes, and they almost bankrupted the company. So,
but the brand, I mean, I think they still have that same brand DNA, right? Which is doing things differently.
Yeah. What's your longer term forecast for the space? Which, you know, I mean, we've talked about the consolidation of the NFL audience. Uh-huh. The Super Bowl is not going to become a particularly smaller broadcast event anytime soon. But, you know, with everything around it, all the other rituals around it, the halftime show and everything else, which we've barely even touched on, like, how do you think this market will change?
Yeah, it's funny. Like, every year that I've been here, we quote the price for a Super Bowl ad, and it's like more than doubled in my 15 years, right? Like I mentioned, up to $8 million. And there's even more than that, like, because a lot of the networks selling them, they're asking for that $8 million for your particular Super Bowl ad, and then they're asking you to commit to spend almost that much in other advertising with the network. So it's this massive ask, and they're still getting demand for it. One of the things I wonder if they're starting to ask for a little bit too much, and if they're not, because they can fill the demand, but I'm wondering if we're going to see the class, you know, the same number of brands that come back year in and year again, right? I think they're relying a lot on these newcomer brands to fill like a quarter of that gap, which is I could create a little more work for your ad sales team to continually define a whole new group of brands willing to pay this money, you know, versus just having it on autopilot where you can count on the same brands coming back every year. Because some of those brands have not come back. Mars, the candy company, you know, used to be regularly. I mean, that was another classic ad. I should have thought that one. The Betty White ad was a Super Bowl ad. You're not you when you're hungry.
Yeah.
But that Snickers, they would always do Snickers or M&M every year. And Mars has not been in the game in a couple of years. And I think, I haven't done the math on this, but I would guess that we're seeing fewer long-time returnees come back as they're relying more and more on these, like, quote-unquote new economy brands, whether it's, you know, OpenAI, you know, the ChatGPT company, they're coming back this year for the second ad. You're kind of relying on what is the current economic boom industry. Yeah. And I guess that's okay, but...
Yeah, I suppose there's also there's a balance to be struck between what's the kind of price of admission, but also you want people, you know, to have the money and the cultural cachet and relevance to create the excitement around that spot, so that everybody else who then you're selling to the following year or, you know, 3 years down the line, given the rotation among the networks, like, you're creating that anticipation and that demand at the same time. Okay. Any that you're looking out for in particular this year?
I mentioned OpenAI. That's one of them we haven't seen yet. I think given where we are right now in the world, just in the last 12, since they ran their ad last year and whole year later, I mean, my gosh, AI is 10 times bigger than it was a year ago. So like, I'm curious to see what they do. And then we haven't gotten into this conversation, whole nother podcast, but the use of AI to make ads is something we're watching. You know, one of them is Svedka Vodka, the vodka brand is projected, you know, publicly said, we're using AI to make this ad. And there's a lot of backlash, I don't know, in the UK, but in the US, when people find out that AI is being used to do some of this stuff, it creates a little backlash around, you know, just opens up a whole can of worms, like job loss and all that kind of stuff.
I think Coca-Cola did something at Christmas that was similar as well. Christmas is another big time for us, for advertising. All right, well, fascinating stuff. I've got three questions that I ask every guest, and we've, you know, we've had a completely different conversation. A lot of the people who are on this podcast, the sports journalists and filmmakers and stuff, and this is a slightly different thing. So I don't know whether you want to answer these questions about advertising or about sports storytelling, because we haven't really touched on sports storytelling at all. So, I mean, I'll leave it up to you, EJ, whether you think that's, which you think is more appropriate.
Let's give it a shot. Let's see what, I can answer your regular questions. We'll see how I do. Well,
the first regular question is, do you have an origin story or something that, that sparked your interest in sport?
You know, I mean, you mentioned sports journalists. I, when I was a kid, like a lot of, I mean, I'm a huge sports fan myself. I always thought I wanted to be, when I was a kid, I was like, my dream was to like write for Sports Illustrated, right? But then the older I got, my concern was, if I'm writing about something I love, it's going to take the fun out of it. So I kind of, that's what, you know, I'm kind of glad I'm not, I get enough sports through the advertising lens to sort of scratch my itch, but I'm not having to like, you know, go, cover a basketball game at 8 o'clock at night, you know, which I love that as a hobby. And I think it would ruin it for me personally if I had to like make it a job.
That makes a lot of sense. I mean, has, did you have much exposure to advertising before you joined Ad Age, or
I did not. I was a newspaper reporter covering government and politics in California. And I saw sadly the trajectory of newspapers, which I love. But I was looking for another way to stay in journalism, and I literally blindly applied to Ad Age based on an online job listing. And I'm like, okay, I felt like this kind of publishing maybe had a little bit of a staying power because it's more business to business oriented, but it's advertising. It's not like I'm writing about tax policy or anything completely boring. It's really a window into pop culture and a lot of things we've talked about today. So it makes it interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. What's your favorite piece of sports storytelling? And that can be an ad, or it can be, maybe it won't be.
This is a random answer, but one of our reporters wrote a story about hype videos.
Okay, yeah.
And I'm a sucker for a good hype video, whether it's a team introduction video. I think we've seen a lot of creativity in these things recently. And so that's my answer.
Yeah. What are your expectations from Sunday in that respect? Because what's the trend there? Because that's another one where, like, I mean, we have them here. We have montages, which tend to be more kind of reflective, and like, you know, we don't have the sort of player or actor sort of down the barrel of the camera, like really psyching people up for the.
I mean, I'm thinking, there's a traditional one I'm thinking of is when you're at the basketball game and they're introducing your team and they play the video, right, to fire up the student section.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Yeah. No, I see.
But you're right. There's other extensions of this that live online now only.
Yeah.
And you're kind of, you know, you're selling what in a lot of cases is the myth of your sports franchise.
Yeah.
you know, in the US here, you know, obviously the Kansas City Chiefs had dominated for like 10 years until this year. And they weren't even in the NFL players, but there was so much built up around that, with the entertaining content, and they were able to play into Travis Kelce's relationship with Taylor Swift, and it becomes this massive art marketing operation beyond just traditional sports marketing.
Yeah, that is actually a thing. The in venue thing is a thing that now has kind of as the pregame ritual is more of a managed part of the day, because it used to be like football matches, people would come in and they'd sing for 20 minutes, and then it would, you know, the game of kickoff, there wasn't a lot of dressing around it. But yeah, that kind of thing of having the hype video on the screen is a bigger part now here in Europe as well. What's a sports story you'd like to tell or see someone else tell?
So this might not be as relevant in the UK, but I'm a big college sports fan.
Mm-hmm.
And basketball in particular, and the rules have completely changed around this through the name, image, and likeness legislation, right? Where now players can actually make money.
Yeah.
And I'm always interested to see the evolution of that. I mean, gets a lot of coverage already, but how that's complete. I mean, college sports in the US is being completely upended because of this, and it's basically being professionalized. And like, as that's happening, it's kind of ruining some of the charm. I mean, yes, a lot of people make good arguments that these athletes have done a lot for their universities and their colleges and they deserve to be paid money, but it's completely lawless right now. And it's the complete Wild West. So I think watching that whole space play out in the next few years is kind of something that fascinates me.
Yeah, that would be, yeah, definitely something really to watch, because at the moment it's also not, they're not being paid directly. It's sort of, there's lots of workarounds. There will be, for sure, things that come out.
I mean, and from what I do it for a living, there's a brand angle there, because theoretically you're supposed to be, you know, have a deal with a brand as your player. It ultimately just becomes a way for a booster to pay a player. So what are the actual brands getting out of this? Is it actually effective marketing?
Yeah, we shall see. One more question, EJ. This is going to be the thing that ages the quickest. You got a pick for Sunday?
A pick versus who I'm rooting for? I'm rooting for Seattle, and I do think Seattle will win. I think they've got a better defense. I think that New England kind of burst on the scene a little bit prematurely. So I think Seattle's the better rounded team, and I think they'll win.
Yeah, good to have a name on the trophy as well. That's not been there for a while.
Right, that's the other thing.
Yeah. All right, well, EJ, it's been a real pleasure and fascinating chat.
Thanks for having me.
Enjoy the game and the ads.
Yeah.
Outlines is an original production from 2640.